because I could breach my security clearance. So let me concentrate for a minute and explain something.
Yeah.
When you're looking at a Navy jet, and you can go all the way back to the 70s for this, when it's shooting camera, it's shooting and usually about 18 or 20 different types of camera. Or there's a lot of different things involved, especially today, because there's a lot of digital involved, high def, stuff like that. So that's not the only image coming off of it. That's the image the Navy decided to share with you. But it shows you, in cold, it shows you in hot, it shows you, it'll actually outline the craft for you and turn the craft. It'll give you distance, height, altitude, shape, size, and how fast it's moving. This is all on the screen for the pilot to see. So when a pilot tells you he sees something unidentified, he's telling you it's something unidentified. That doesn't mean it's an alien craft. It just means it's unidentified. But the problem is, like I just said, pilots don't get aircraft wrong, or they wouldn't be a pilot. Military pilots would get fired if they misrepresented any type of aircraft. They would lose their job and their commission. They have to know what they're looking at so there's not accidents like when the Russians shot down that jet or when we shot down that jet. It's the whole reason for this. They're very strict about this. This is something that's very passionate about the military and the Navy, particularly because they get the best Air Force. So they want to be real careful about this. So when you see these images and the Navy tells you it doesn't know what it is, it's pretty much telling you it's not a Russian, Chinese, or commercial aircraft. It still doesn't mean it's an alien craft. It just means it's probably not one of those three.
Right. Well, you know what Occam's razor is, right? Mm-hmm. Occam's razor. And by the way, we're science and beyond, not speculation and beyond.
That's right.
But Occam's razor basically says that the most simplest explanation, you like that? I was telling Seraphine tonight, maybe I should call it speculation and beyond, but Occam's razor basically, as most scientists know, is that the simplest explanation is usually the correct one. For example, if these blips can be explained by infrared, imaging, and it fits other types of similar, experiences, maybe not 100%, that is the most logical explanation than to postulate their crafts from a different galaxy or crafts that even we have. But that's the only thing I want people to be careful out there. Our imagination runs wild, like Planet X. I mean, that's the biggest joke. I always tell people, if you believe in Planet X, I have land to sell you there. And I also throw in a condo on the dark side of the moon overlooking McDonald's that says over 8 billion aliens served. So, I mean, trying to say not to rule out what we don't know about. And part of tonight, I really want to talk about, what real evidence do we have for extraterrestrials and UFOs? And not
we've
to rule
got,
them out.
We've got the Mexico City sighting.
Yeah.
That's all you ever need. You don't need anything more than that. That's
like,
all you ever need.
For example, how many people you think that saw these videos knew anything about flipping infrared imaging and stuff
like that?
Yeah,
see, you were wrong about that going left thing, by the way.
Just tell me when it was invented.
Wait, listen.
You don't even have the facts on the show.
No, I'm going to give you the facts right now. Just plant his banking left, John. You can see it on the screen. The horizon meter is banking. This plane you're looking at is chasing this thing, banking left.
You know what the flip camera works on those crafts?
No, it's not a matter what the flip camera works on. There is a horizon meter in the middle of the screen. It's not parallel. It's tilted to the right, which means the plane is banking. This is basic aircraft
physics. Because
of
the change in magnification.
No, it's not going to be tilted.
You obviously never used a flip camera on a plane.
No.
But you would know this.
That is your meter. That's the thing that tells you if your plane's level or not.
Tell me about the...
John, stop. Now you're really embarrassing yourself. Just don't. I got a degree in avionics as well, John. So, look, don't. That is what that is. Look, you can watch it on the screen. It's moving as the plane's turning. It's moving. That represents your wings. If that thing is tilted, that means the wings of the jet is tilted. It means the plane is banking. That's simple physics. That's just how everyone works. It doesn't matter what kind of camera you're using. That indicates what the plane's level is.
I've ever heard. It doesn't matter on the camera. Oh, my God. Joe, you have not.
This isn't the camera. This is the image you're looking through at the front of the aircraft. What that is your altimeter and your level of your flight. That's what that little line is going across it. That's what that represents, where your wings are. That's just fact. You can go look on any
sensor and a
any
flip
jet
camera.
Plane you want to look on, that's what you're going to see on the screen. It's right there. Check where your wings are.
I asked you three or four questions about the flip camera. You could answer none of them.
What are you talking about? You didn't even give me a question. John, this isn't about the camera. This is about aircraft travel.
Okay,
and if it's on there, it's not banking. This, you're not even, don't even know what you're talking about. What you're looking at there is the image going through the front of the jet. That's the actual screen that's in front of the guy on the screen in front of him. That's what he's seeing. That's not just the camera. That's what lens he's got on his screen inside the jet. You're not going to have your altimeter and your wing level not on the screen. You're flying a plane at Mach 2. Jesus, man, come on. You better go study aviation. I'm going to tell you now, because I don't even want to get into this. If you're not going to go study aviation and understand basic flight, there ain't no reason to have this conversation. There's just not.
Technology
is just infrared technology. It's nothing. We've been having it for 30 years. This is nothing new. You got cool view, you got hot view, you got red view, you got green view. You've got about 16 different views from one set of cameras in the front of the jet, which I shouldn't even be talking about.
You're testifying in Congress because you don't answer the question.
Wait a minute, I just answered the question.
My question is, explain to me the technical specifications of a flip camera, and did you know that a pinpoint of infrared light with a flip camera would look like a bat shape?
Why not? Look, stop for a minute. Who do you think, which one of the two of us you think has seen more cameras on a jet, on an actual aircraft, on a board aircraft carrier? Who do you think seen more, me or you? Really?
Answer the question.
How many? For every one you've ever even looked at, I've probably looked at 100. Dude, I used to install these on these jets. Please do not argue with something you do not know about.
You don't know about the electronics of a flip camera. You can't even answer my questions.
I got advanced degrees in electronics, right? Don't. You're going to embarrass yourself here, man. You're going to embarrass yourself here. These are basic infrared cameras. There's nothing special about them other than distance control and the actual magnification of the zoom. There's nothing special about these cameras.
This isn't anything
special. And what you were talking about, the thing banking, it was banking. This thing is under pursuit. You can even see the guy in the pilots are telling you on the screen what he's doing. I'm banking left. And you're going to argue about it when you can simply see the wings twisted to the left and the guy on the screen saying, I'm banking left, seeing what this is. But you're still going to argue about it. Stop it.
Okay.
It makes you look bad when you do that.
Oh, okay. Here's the thing. When the switch goes from a one power to a two power zoom, it gives the object appearing of teleporting to the left. This is right out of military.
This isn't teleporting, John. This is turning. You can watch the horizon. Look, just go look at it. Go look at it. It's on the screen. You can see the cloud. Listen, John, before I embarrass you even further, see the cloud deck tilted to the right, which means the plane is banking left.
Can I say something uninterrupted for a minute, please?
No, now you're going to keep saying dumb shit. No.
I'm quoting this from an infrared source, okay? A technology book.
It doesn't matter what you're quoting. We're not arguing about that. We don't care about the infrared. We're trying to explain to you that the plane is banking left.
You're letting me take a minute in a two-hour show? Can I take 1 minute, please?
No, okay. Not really.
The camera stops tracking the object when it changes the zoom. The switch from a 1x zoom to a 2x zoom gives the object the appearance of teleporting to the left. It continues.
And what's that got to do with anything we're talking about?
It's consistent with a distant flying craft with no sudden movements.
Ladies and gentlemen, do me a favor. Go look at the video and you can see the plane banking left and the clouds moving underneath it. I don't know why John's keeping trying to argue something that you can clearly see he's wrong about.
I'm talking unless you let me finish. You can do the whole show the rest of yourself if you want.
The water line. Well, I mean, you're talking about something, John, that you're trying to make a point that you can't.
The gimbal was lit by the infrared flare of the engine and locked in place by a trick of the gimbal-mounted camera viewing it. In a series of several videos, you can walk through it, and it produces the exact effect seen in the Navy footage, including the rotating glare and imaging sharpening in IR cameras. I can go on and on.
And you still you ain't said anything. You just didn't say anything. You didn't rebut anything that I just said about the cameras, about the plane tilting, about the thing being chased, about the planes being on a tilt. You didn't address any of that. All you went off on a thing you wanted to talk about for some reason or another that has nothing to do with what we're talking about.
Oh, it doesn't. I just explained why.
It doesn't.
It doesn't, John,
because we're not talking about flare. You can't even see a flare in these videos. There's no flare going on here. This is a plane banking left pursuing something that's cold.
You just keep talking. I'll just sit here. When you're done, I'll talk.
I'm just telling you, you won't go even look at the video.
I did.
I mean, you're arguing about something, you ain't even looked at it. That's like the night when we were talking about, oh man, I know, guys. I agree with y'all.
I just explained why the shape is the way it is. I explained why it looked like it showed.
You did. You didn't explain anything.
I just read it.
No, you didn't, John. That was booga booga. You did not explain anything. Nothing that we were talking about prior to that little thing you went on to explain anything we were talking about. You're not telling me how the clouds are moving under the plane on a tilted angle. That does not explain that, John. It doesn't. It doesn't explain the pilot going, oh, we're banking left now in pursuit of the aircraft as the altimeter is moving along with it. You didn't explain any of that. None of that has been explained.
The shape the way it does. I explained why it appears to the left when the zoom is changed.
It's not appearing to the left. The plane is, if you're telling me you can't tell that that plane's banking left, you got issues, dude. You need to go get checked out. I mean, really, no, John. You can't tell that plane is banking left. I mean, all you got to do is look at the clouds underneath the plane to tell you what it's doing. There's nothing jumping left. This thing is in motion at high speed.
An alien sitting on it driving it, and that explains
it. I have no idea if there's an alien in it or not. All I know is you've got a jet chasing something at high speed with the pilot saying, I'm banking left to catch up with the target.
I'll do it all over again if you want. I explained exactly everything that was seen on that film based on an infrared.
All right. Explain to me how the clouds will move and banking left. If your theory's right, tell me how the clouds will move and banking left. The film ain't going to do that.
Let me finish and don't keep interrupting me. Okay?
Because you didn't explain it.
I just did. And you keep interrupting me.
You can say you did until you blew in the face, but you did not. You did not. All you did was him and her about some technical specs, but you didn't say anything about how the plane was banking. And look, let's finish this. Let's finish this. So you're saying it jerked to the left because of the film. So then after it jerked, why did it keep going left?
That's an illusion.
Why did it keep going? And it's still going. I mean, it's still going. This thing's, we're 20 minutes in and it's still going left. But it jerked because of the film.
Do you know how it locks on it? That's another question.
Oh, my God.
You ignored every. I just gave you all the technical specifications to explain why the pilots saw what they did.
You didn't explain anything. You didn't explain anything about these videos we're watching right now. Because first off, I set you up on one of them because it's actually banking right.
Wait, these
are completely wrong. Wait, let me finish. I just set you up on one of them, and you can go watch the video for yourself after the show. It's banking right, not left. So you got one video we've been watching that the plane is banking right, which completely just boguses out your theory altogether.
I said the object looked like it was going right when it changed zoom.
You said it was going left. Now, come on. You can't be changing your story in the middle of the show, man. You do know this is taped, right? You do know this is taped.
These are engineering infrared research.
I know. Even the chat room's giving you shit now, man.
It's funny because I said when I did my own research on the infrared military research, when I saw that first photo of that plane, that one of the three they released, my first instinct was, my God, I bet an infrared heat source would explain it. And then I did the research. I checked with some infrared technology experts, and they said, oh, this is so typical. They gave me YouTube.
According to the video, the U.S. Navy video, the plane is on a 22-degree angle banking left.
This is shit. I'm explaining how the image was.
I'm explaining to you what the Navy just said the aircraft was doing. It is on a 22-degree angle banking left. So now you're going to argue with the official explanation from the Navy. I don't even talk to you about it. Let's move on. I don't even talk to you about it anymore. Now you're going to argue about it. Now the other one is taken from above. It's not jogging left or right. It's taken from above straight down. But I guess that's also the camera film.
On my site, I am going to post all these articles and the YouTube videos.
This one's on 33-degree angle. Damn.
Were sent to me by experts, okay? So if somebody didn't understand what I'm saying now and think I was making it up, I will report on the sources, the pictures. I will actually even include YouTube videos showing similar phenomena that they knew were heat sources from planes.
Yeah, but you got to show the sources of the videos, John. You can't just go put somebody's bullshit homemade video up there. You got to have source videos.
It's a UFO.
If you're going to go put some bullshit, because YouTube, most videos on YouTube are bullshit, so let's just be honest about that now. Most UFO videos on YouTube are garbage and they're fake.
By experts in infrared.
What expert? John, I am an expert in aircraft aviation. Just so you know that, my friend, I am. I got the degree to go along with it.
you flip camera. You haven't even explained what the glare filter looks like. You know,
didn't explain what it looks like. And so I'm going to put you on another hot spot since I just blew your cover with these three videos playing up there, because all of them just rebutted everything you just said. Because you said, it jogged to the left. Oh, well, it didn't do that, did it? Well, the videos didn't do anything. But you said the three videos we just played didn't do anything that you just tried to explain. So that's why I told you should have been watching the videos before you started running your mouth. This goes back to the thing like Ancient Aliens. You need to pay attention before you open your mouth.
Oh, look who's talking.
I pay attention.
Camera footage calculates the speed and distance of the perceived object. It's actually moving slowly at a high altitude. It explains phenomena.
They use radar to determine speed and altitude of any aircraft in pursuit of. Okay, I don't know where you're getting any other bullshit, because anything other than that is bullshit.
You know what the ATF...
not the way aircraft work. It's not the way the military works. That's why we have advanced radar systems that we can say where a plane is and how fast the plane is going. And the reason we have them set on center spots on ships is so we can see below 500 feet.
Do you know what an ATFLIR is?
No. Do you know what K59721 is?
What's an ATFLIR?
No, do you? Do you know what a K4 filter is?
I'm not a Navy guy.
Do you know what a blue silk filter is?
They were using.
If you know about flare cameras, then you know what a blue silk filter is. If you don't, then you don't know anything about this. Okay. See, because all cameras have filter sets in them, John. All cameras that we have on board planes have filter sets in them. And the reason they do is so that the pilot has the option, because of certain types of weather, it's easier to see in certain types of imaging. Reason we did that, and we've been doing that since the 70s. We do it in all high def. Now we don't even use standard kickout anymore, because we use high def, which is sent out, by the way, on a whole different signal. Okay. It's a whole different signal. It's a whole different modulated signal. Not modulated, it's a whole different signal.
I want to clarify something too. I'm not 100% that this is the facts. All I'm saying is, of all the all the possibilities that I've looked into, this to me is the most plausible. And like I said, what I found very interesting is that looking at the footage, the first thing I thought, being having a government grant in infrared research, is like, my God, this really looks similar to an infrared source that would be, this kind of type of image would be produced by it. And by zooming and by all these other factors that I mentioned could cause exactly what I'm looking at. And that's the most plausible explanation. Then it's some extraterrestrial or UFO or some supersonic.
Actually, John, it is a UFO. In any way you go about it, it's a UFO. I got one question for you.
Yeah.
I want you to tell me it's not a UFO.
A UFO just means an unidentified.
Exactly. So you just said it wasn't a UFO. It's exactly what it is, a UFO.
But
exactly what you're looking at. You're looking at a UFO because it's simply unidentified flying object.
It's moving at fast speeds, making fast turns, and all this stuff. And the shape is what it looks like. Those are all factors of the flip camera. That's all I'm saying.
None of what you just said is even true.
Feeling
none of that has anything to do with the flip camera. Flip camera does not do
but
that.
You
John.
Made the plan that got you here.
You must think our pilots are ignorant.
With a shield level annuity from the White House Financial, your portfolio can benefit from growth potential with a level of protection from market volatility. To help you follow your plans wherever they take you, talk to your financial professional about shield level annuity. White House Financial.
Like you just said, it would miss half the time they fired the damn missile. It doesn't work that way. That's what I was trying to explain to you. That's not how the system works. The system has a lock track system. It locks onto a target. It acquires a target. It holds a target and it tracks the target the entire time unless the craft gets out of range.
Didn't you even listen to the audio and said, okay, it lost. It got unlocked. Now it's locked again. So, I mean, it goes on and off. And by the way, I'm just quoting
This craft is sitting at, look, I mean, it gives you all the information you need right on the screen. See, that's a different, ladies and gentlemen. That's the difference about someone who served and different didn't serve. Because every set of numbers on that screen, I know what they're for.
Okay. I'm going to sum up my speculation, and then this is speculation from my research in the infrared military technology, looking at the pictures and doing the research. I believe it was a heat signature from a commercial plane. It could have been a balloon. It could have been some object that left this heat signature in that place. It could have been a plane, slow-moving balloon, that the flip camera locked on it because of the change in magnification, because of the filter and the flare. It produced the shape, the apparent movement to the left when it didn't move, when it changed magnification, and all the other phenomena could simply be explained as a heat signature that a flip camera picked up. Period. Now,
okay. Now I'm gonna tell you why you're wrong. Now let me go. Now you went. Now let me go. Now let me tell you why you're wrong. First off, military aircraft are not allowed to fly at altitudes of commercial airlines. Period. It is illegal, and you will lose your damn job. The pilot, either commercial pilot or the military pilot, will lose their job right then and there. Bam, you're fired. Done and over with. That's against FCC regulations and military regulations.
What was the altitude?
So you're not going to have any commercial. You're not going to have any military flights at the same altitudes of commercial. Just going to. It doesn't matter what it. They're not going to be at the same altitude. They're going to be at least 15,000 feet apart at any given time because jets move really, 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 really fast. Commercial airlines move really, really sluggish and slow. And one of them are going against the wind. Straight down video where the target lock, the missile locks in, because this was actually a missile lock.
They do say, I've seen and I've read and I've heard and I did have one very brief meeting off that people are saying the same UFO. Do I believe
it? And by the way, the F-18 that was chasing the one we're talking about right now could not keep up with the object. Okay, now, as far as I know currently, the only plane that can outrun an F-18 is an F-22. That's it. There ain't nobody else can run any faster than that. Nobody out there goes any faster than that. There's no commercial plane even got a shot.
Seems like they locked on it for quite a while until the heat signature disappears.
Yeah, they lost them. The plane left them. Whatever was in front of them left the F-18 at a full burn. They left F-18 at full burn.
You never planned on the regeneration feeling so at home.
No commercial airline. Commercial airlines automatically got you here. But there's no commercial airline.
With a shield level annuity from the Concorde couldn't fly it. Your portfolio was supersonic with a level of from market volatility to help you follow your plans wherever they take you. Talk to your financial professional about shield level annuities. Bright House Financial, build for what's ahead.
We've watched, while you've been yapping, we've watched four different videos. In all four videos, they've done what happened. What happened? The object left the plane in the dust. In all four videos. And the pilot's like, oh my God, it's moving away, it's moving away, it's moving away at high speed, it's gone.
And he also said
it was no heat signature to start off
anybody
with.
In the U.S.
Simple
Senate,
as that.
There was and actually, in the flares we're looking at, there is no heat signature. So I don't even know what you're talking about when you say heat signature.
There is so much about what comes
None
out
of this
Donald
is heat.
Trump's
There's no heat involved in this. These are cool pictures.
The
what
is
it? Grayscale.
From what he is
doing grayscale meaning there's no heat.
That is about
what
we're
doing. This object is not even producing heat. No, you're leaving the plane in the dust. I don't care
Absolutely.
What you say. That's not that's the advanced
he
Russian technology.
Like
you don't know how to get a word in.
No
I'm just saying.
Like
oh, wait. Joe Biden's
no
stuck in.
So you don't let anybody get a word in. Flip is infrared. And you're telling me there's no heat? What the fuck do you think? I've excused my language here. What do you think infrared means? Infrared means heat. So you're telling me the flip infrared camera is not picking up a heat signature? That is totally.
It's ridiculous. Not what it's picking up. It's picking up what they call cold shield. That's what it's picking up. It's because, and see, you would know this if you served. Okay, what happens is objects moving at high speeds, the outer shell gets heated, but the inner core, if it's not running any kind of hot engine, stays cool. And that's what you see here. You see an outer shell that's warmed up and a center that's not, which means there's no jet engine there or it would be hotter than the outer wings.
That's true.
Because first,
it's simple.
John, this is really easy to understand. Okay, jet fuel burns at 2,400 degrees Fahrenheit. Okay, well, the JP5 we use burned at, or JP4.
I have a great idea.
2,500 degrees. So anything you would be out there, that jet fuel would show much hotter.
I got a great idea.
It would show much hotter.
Let's bring on some infrared technology experts next week. I probably can contact you.
Technology experts.
Let's do that. And let's see. let then the audience decide. You want to do that for next week? That'd be a fun show.
There's no audience to decide. It's not the camera's not going to make a difference because you're not discussing what happened in the video. You're just trying to say it's a flare, and that's what it is. And two of these, by the way, two of these cameras are not flare. They're not infrared. These are cold blue cameras. These are not infrared cameras. John just got off an infrared and didn't realize what he was talking about.
Okay, then
a couple of these cameras you see in these images of are not infrared cameras. And like I just said, the outer cone, you can see the glow. You can see the glow or whatever it is around the thing, which means it's producing friction against the craft is what it means. But it's, ow. So it's interesting to start off with. But anyway, we got to get Joe Biden off the screen, John. Joe Biden tried to interrupt the show here. I'm not sure how that happened. In case anybody's watching, Joe Biden just popped up on his screen. I guess he figured me and John, he needed to get in here and sneak and get him some.
I don't really got Joe Biden, just put up the pass on it.
I don't know how he got in there, but he got in there. Carol, what are you talking about? No, the Navy's got, they got a full infrared, then they've got passive infrared. They've got a couple of versions of it. It's kind of like Starlight. I don't know how many of y'all are familiar with Starlight cameras or Starlight or blue light or green light. What it is, you can use it in frequencies. So it can be more intense or less intense. So most of the Navy planes are passive, meaning that they're only picking up whatever it hits the surface of. It's not really picking up anything else. So if there's a high heat source, it's going to pick up that first and then everything else secondly. And these two pictures, it's picking up the outer part before it's picking up the inner part, which means one of two things. The outer shell is being heated up by friction, or it's simply moving so fast, it's creating friction on the outer shell, and it's allowing the camera to pick it up. If it was completely jet propelled, then the backside of the thing would be a big, glowing, really hardcore, deep white plume, and it's not there. It's not what you see. You see this outline of this thing with a center belly. It's a very weird shape. It's not an engine like we think of. It could be a drone. Can't rule out. Whatever it is leaving the F-18 in the dust. And like I said, there ain't many things can leave an F-18 in the dust. And you see the pilot in the thing. He says we're at full burn, which means he's chocking. Well, I can't say the real speed, but we'll just say he's doing plus Mach 2.5. So he's hauling ass. So whatever this thing is moving away from. And you can see the clouds. And what's great about this is, since clouds have different shapes, you can actually track the cloud shapes as he's banking. You can see, you know, it starts off with a flat cloud deck and then it gets kind of humpy. And then you see some more different shapes. And then you see some higher clouds over here and some more clouds off to the left. So you can see him as he's cutting into the surface, moving in there. Like the one above, you can see him because you can see different parts of the ocean. So you can see it moving from one side of the ocean to the other side of the ocean. These things are moving pretty fast, whatever they are. It could be some kind of what's that thing we fly in space, John? What's that, DARPA jet? You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
It could be something like that. And you know what?
That's possible. That's really.
And you know what about that, John? On reentries, it comes in at like Mach 36, and it wouldn't have a back plume because it doesn't use an engine to come in. It glides in. So the outer shell would be hot, and the center would not. So it could be that. You can't rule that out. That's what I'm saying. That's why you always classify them as UFOs, and you go from there.
Let's change the subject a little bit because I want to get some fun things in tonight. And actually, I kind of enjoyed that discussion because it really shows there's a lot more research needs to be done. Here's a question, and this has bothered me for a long time, and I'm not an expert on this, so you're not going to get an argument from me because I don't really know. A lot of people have claimed to work, you know, top secrets on propulsion systems of supposedly UFOs that we recovered. And one of those is Bob Lazar. And I really don't know much about him. When Stan Friedman was alive, I was very good friends with Stan. We used to talk all the time. And I know he had his skepticism about it. What's your take on that, you know?
Well, Bob's a little different for me. I've had insider information for a long time, so it's a little different for me. But a friend of mine worked at Los Alamos, actually still does work at Los Alamos. And then I had some friends of mine that worked at both Yucca and Wicca facilities as well. So they're really high up in the range. Now, I'm going to tell you what they sent me. They sent me an employee list. And, you know, I got a high clearance level, so it's not going to get me in trouble. But they sent me an employee list for Los Alamos, and his name was on it. But his name was not listed as a scientist. His name was listed as a, not a janitor, they called it something else, but basically somebody who took care of the building itself.
Really?
But that's what he was listed as. So, you know, was it true or not? I don't know. It would explain a lot of things, because there's a lot of things he knows, but there's a lot of things he don't know for someone who was up close to a craft. So there's gaps in his stories, and he's had some questionable other things when he came up. But I don't know. I mean, you know, without sitting down and talking to him or giving him voice stress analysis. What do you mean? Who do you want me to voice stress, Sarah? Who? I don't think so. You're crazy. No, really? No, indeed not. No, that's what John and I were just talking about. We were arguing about the flare cameras, the infrared cameras, and then we were talking about the DARPA plane. Could have been one of the explanations. Yeah, you got to remember, all we were saying is they're UFOs. We weren't really arguing about exactly. If they were alien craft or not. We were just arguing about how it got there.
We're arguing possibilities. So the thing that bothered me about Bob Lazar, and maybe it did you also, and I'm a physicist, and he doesn't really have a lot of academic credentials. So why would they bring somebody in like him to a highly classified thing? I always wonder about that, where there's high level, you know, PhD propulsion experts at Caltech and MIT, and that was something that bothered me. Unless for some reason, you know, not everybody doesn't go to college. Some of them are brilliant, you know. So, but I'd like a physicist. I would love to talk to him physics and see, does he really know his physics? That's what I'm curious.
That's an interesting question, because I did talk with him with physics, and I've held my own with Michio Kaku and Neil deGrasse Tyson, Leavitt. So I can actually talk some pretty good physics, but I didn't feel he knew as much as I did. And by the way, guys, I'm not a physicist. I'm a layman. Well, maybe a little more than a layman, but somewhere in the middle up in there. But still, he was having a hard time keeping up with, and we were talking a lot of basic stuff. I mean, really? We were talking about some of Einstein's theories and faster than light travel. He really didn't know what light speed was. And I would think you would, if you were that kind of scientist, you would know light speed.
Sure.
And then on two occasions, he wanted to use miles per hour on light speed. I was like, no, it's miles per second. What are you doing here, man? You're scaring me here. But yeah, I mean, he might've been stressed, and it was a pretty big interview, so he might've been nervous. To be honest with you, and this is what I get from Lazar. I don't really believe him. I'm not going to lie to y'all. But I don't get the sense that he's lying either. And I'm usually a pretty good judge of character. That's why I like you. So it's one of them things that, it's a weird thing. It's kind of like Charles Hall's thing with the, you know, when he told me about the white, I have no doubt that he believed every word he told me. No, I could have voice stressed him until I was blue in the face. I could have had him polygraphed. He would have passed everyone because he believed what he was telling me. Now, whether it was true or not, I don't know. And I have doubts about a lot of what he told me. But still, but it's the same thing. Yeah, but he believes it. And I think in Lazar's case, maybe he was bait for us, for people out in the field, you know, to jump on. And
sure.
Because, ladies and gentlemen, remember this. This is the government we're talking about. And we're talking about the secret government at this point. So if they really thought you knew something that could bring light to something that they didn't want you, then he'd be dead. He'd have gotten a car wreck or a bus wreck. I've been threatened myself a couple of times. So, you know, and what gets me is, and the way they usually do it is they didn't actually, the first two times, they didn't even threaten me. They threatened my family. They threatened my son and my wife, and they even knew where they were when they called me. So it was really weird. It's a strange thing. Well, because I was probably digging around stuff I shouldn't have been, Carol. It's just, you know, sometimes I get into some deep research and get into places I've got a lot of friends in the military, and because of my high clearance, I get to hear stuff because I can't say anything, and they know I can't because they know my clearance, and they check it. Anytime I'm dealing with people from certain big companies or some friends of mine or still work for the government, they actually check it. As long as it's active, they're fine. They can't get in any trouble because most of the time my clearance is higher than theirs.
And you know, people don't realize too, when you sign the non-disclosure agreement, which I'm sure you have, obviously, there's no date of expiration on it.
Well, and that's true.
I got to say this. My best friend, which, you know, we had him on our show, right, the NSA cryptologist, and he actually was the one who invented cyber war for this country. And we were talking about that. And I said, okay, Jim, so let's say you worked on a classified object. And now it's declassified. Okay, Joe? So now it's given out to the public. Can you now talk about it? Because you signed that you would not disclose this. It doesn't say assuming the government doesn't. And it's a question that we couldn't answer. I said, he kind of said it probably would have to be tested in court. So that's the problem, though. Once you sign something like that, you're pretty much got to keep your mouth shut for life, you know?
Well, what you do and you don't, it's weird. First off, there's two different kinds. There's one that's lifetime, which is one I had to get when I got on the carrier. That was a lifetime thing. It was for life because certain things that we worked on are going to be classified till I die. So it's just one of them things. But the one I had to sign for the sighting was different. It was only a 35-year thing. You signed it, it expired in 35 years. And then there's other things. So the Navy told me, like, I got reprimanded one time for talking about EMP shielding aboard F-14 Tomcats. And I didn't know it was still classified. So that's when the Navy told me. He said, look, if we declassify it, you can talk about it as an expert, feel free. If we had, and that's like what I was telling you when we were arguing about the cameras, there's things I know about the cameras I can't talk about because they're still classified. There's certain things the cameras can do, and there's certain things that the cameras can do that actually we could actually get more information about on these things, which bothers me, by the way, about the Pentagon, because there are other versions of this picture that you and I are talking about taken from different filters and different cameras that would give you a good bit more information. But you notice they didn't release those, more than likely because the camera itself or the filter itself is still classified. Exactly.
That's what I was told.
You know? So that's probably why.
Joe, you're exactly right on that. I asked somebody, why didn't they release the other thing? And they said, because it would give away some of the operational, details of that.
They do not want the Chinese and Russians to know that basically we can see the pilot smiling in the cockpit. That's what they don't want them to know.
Well, I said something interesting about Bob Lazar. Maybe I'll just digress here for a second, because one of my closest friends was a top CIA polygraph who actually did the polygraph on James Earl Ray, who shot Martin Luther King. And he told me that the polygraph showed that Martin Luther King, that James Earl Ray was telling the truth. He did it alone. And here's the other interesting thing. He also, remember the Amityville Horror, right? In Long Island, the Lutz family, they thought they were faking it, called my friend Chris Gugas, who passed away. He was, again, the top polygraph expert in the world. To do a polygraph on them. And Chris told me that it showed they were telling the truth. But in my research in the Amityville Horror, I have questions about the legitimacy of it. Even the lawyer of the Lutz family said they made it up. There's a lot of controversy, but right.
If somebody and that's one of the ones you got to take as who do you believe?
If somebody believes that they're going to show they're telling the truth, but that doesn't mean the event was true. That was a good point you made that, what did Stan think? Stan was very...
In the beginning, Stan was very standoffish on Lazar. But as he got older, I think he warmed up to him a little bit. Maybe because they were just looking for allies. And, he was supposed to be a physicist. And, of course, Stan was a physicist.
Right.
And actually, Jimmy, Stan did not have a PhD. He got on my ass about that because every now and then I would slip up and call him doctor. Yeah. I'd call him doctor. He said, no, Joe, I still work for it. I got to mad and get my PhD, which, and I would forget everything. Because he was very knowledgeable about it. Funny?
I love Stan.
You might like this show, too. I did a show with Stanton Freeman on nothing but nuclear physics and what he did while he was a nuclear physicist. Nothing to do with UFOs. If you're looking for that, there's no UFO, nothing at all about UFOs in that show. It's simply about Stanton Freeman before UFOs and what he thought about physics and what kind of physicist he was and who he worked for. And that's what we talked about. It was a really good show. I learned more about the man in that one show than I had done. At that time, I had done 22 shows with Stan. And I learned more about him in that one show than I did in those 22.
I miss Stan. Stan, and Jess Marcells Jr., the son of Jesse Marcells Sr., who was the information officer. Us three had done many radio shows together. And actually, the first show, I was on like three or four different networks before I came here. And by the way, this is the best network 100-fold of any networks I've ever been on, and you're the best producer and owner of any network.
Even though I drive you crazy.
Stan was always my first guest on almost every radio show I ever had.
Because he's a good guest. Let's be honest.
He's a wonderful guy. And when the Roswell, remember the 60th anniversary at Roswell?
Yeah.
I couldn't make it, so I sent my son, who was a UCLA professor, this is before, and Stan and others gave him like the royal carpet treatment.
Oh, yeah, I bet you. You would have got to meet me there. We were actually hosting the Sweeps Week. We ended up being the third highest rated station in the country.
Oh my God, Dennis Balthaser?
Oh, Dennis and I love Dennis.
He's on my board. I just wrote to him the other day. Isn't he a wonderful man?
And he is. And matter of fact, I haven't talked to him in a while, but I was planning on giving him a call. I love to talk UFOs with.
Oh my God, he knows his stuff.
I'm not going to lie. He knows his stuff. Him and Ted Phillips. Ted Phillips does too. They both know their stuff pretty good when it comes to UFOs, and I enjoy talking to both of them.
Thank you, DeLynn, but no, they both.
Yeah, we're doing Babylon 5. We've been theming, haven't we? But anyway, oh no, Balfaze and knows far more about it than I do.
He's on my research board, and he also was on almost every radio show I ever had. I love Dennis.
Yeah, he was always a blast. But, I used to get him and Lloyd Pye back to back. I used to bring them both on back to back.
You should definitely call him, Joe. He would love to hear from you because I know he's not as active as he was, and. I probably will.
I got to look up. I'll hunt him up. I either got his number or his email somewhere, but I'll hunt it up and get it from him because, no, I always enjoyed talking to him. We always had a lot of fun when we talked. He's just so delightfully knowledgeable in this field, and he takes a non-bullshit approach to it, which I really appreciate.
Exactly.
And he always liked me for the same reason Jim Mars did, because I gave him freedom to express it how they wanted to on the show. I didn't bind him up and say, oh, you can't be like that. No, you can do. Jim Mars can talk politics.
Jim Mars, my mouse is on top of Jim Mars' books, Crossfire, because Jim Mars and I were on the same radio network together. We did the same time as a show, but we alternated because I was writing a book with a former Secret Service agent who was on the Kennedy detail, Joe Paolella, and he's the one who discovered the bullet hole in the front windshield of the limo. And he had to guard the limo in the presidential garage. Now, Joe was a Secret Service agent to four presidents and on a JFK detail. And the Warren Commission wouldn't let him talk about it. And I'm the only person he told in 40 years. And so we were writing a book together on the JFK assassination, which we felt we have proof of a second shooter. And that Joe did pass away about a year or two ago. And I've been in touch with his family. We still may write that book, but Jim Mars, oh my God, Jim Mars was the one who found the picture for me of the windshield with the bullet hole in it. And I showed Joe, and Joe says, that's exactly how it looked. Jim Mars
was a godsend. I miss him, man. Him and I, see how you and I fight? We used to fight like that. Matter of fact, Stan and I used to fight like that. Oh man, when I changed the Betty and Barney seal here, oh my God, you should listen to that show. You think we were fighting, man. We got into it. I'm like, Stan. Yeah, I said, Stan, you know I love you, but you don't know what the bleep bleep you're talking about, right? I said, did your wife hit you on the head again? Did you wreck your car and flip upside down? I said, look, dude, you don't know what you're talking about. It was a blast. We had a great time. And we did many, many more interviews after that. But, you know, because most of our interviews were very cordial, but every now and then we'd get into something we just didn't agree on. And I mean, you know, I'm gonna stand my ground. He's gonna stand in. I mean, he makes for great shows too. They were always highly rated shows, by the way, ladies and gentlemen. Oh, y'all should go listen to him. No disrespect to Stan at all. I loved him. We had many, many, many conversations. There's a conversation with him and I, and Jerry Pittman at the 60th anniversary in Roswell, and it's a really good one. And,
you have archives? You have those archives anywhere? But those would be great. Post.
Yeah, they some of them are still available. I actually have been reposting some of them lately. I just posted one with Jerry Pittman the other day.
Really?
Because Jerry used to be on the station in the early days, and then we did a lot of radio together. Him and I, we catch up with each other at conferences, and we would share like booths and stuff so we could get a bigger audience for our radio shows when we were doing, you know, live radio while we were there. And him and I had a blast in Roswell. That's where I met Dr. Rita Lewis at, and she was running around with a tin hat on all weekend. It was hilarious. Oh, no, guys, the 60th. What are we on the 70th now, right? I think we're on the 70th anniversary now. No. I know we up there, people. And now I got a couple of friends in Roswell. Every now and then I stop in there. You know, Guy Malone's down there, and he's with the Alien Resistance Movement. They believe all alien abductions are demonic possessions, yes.
I've heard a lot of that. Yeah, I mean, because of my, you know, I wrote 12 books, and half of them were on Enochian magic and paranormal and spiritualism, and that has come up quite a bit. And also,
you know, it was funny when the very, very first time I heard about them group, these three ladies approached me who had been having some kind of contact or thought they were having some kind of contact, and then had gone and seen these, and then they did an exorcism on them, and they thought it was, you know, gone. And it was fine. I said, well, that's good. You know, if y'all comfortable with it, leave it alone. And one lady said, I just don't feel right. I said, well, you know, whatever you want, we can regress you and just see if there's anything still there, if it's something else or if it's an attachment or it could be any damn thing. And but under hypnosis, it didn't ever actually stop. Whatever it was that was doing it was still doing it even after the thing. And like one of my favorite ones is the woman was had been taken, and she said she was, you know, she said that she had been told to use the to invoke the Jesus's name to save her. So she did, and the aliens pulled her eyes out and turned around so she could look at herself and says, "Yeah, see what your God's going to do now." Obviously, they don't believe in our God. So, yeah, that's what I said. When I heard that story, I was like, maybe they pissed them off, man. I don't know. Let's just leave that story alone. And, and the thing about it is, you want to think these people are just nuts out of their mind. You go, oh, you just lost it. But I know this woman. This woman's raising a family. She's got a serious career. She's an attorney, and a very high-powered, very wealthy attorney at that.
Really?
And, wow. Oh, yeah. And it's just, she's very brilliant. She's very intelligent. But she said, that's, this has been going on since she's been a child. She said, I just wanted to talk to somebody about it. And so she found us. But, you know, you just, well, I didn't say it wasn't a demon. I don't know what it was. You know, it could be extraterrestrial. It could be demon. It could be some kind of manifestation because something happened to her as a child. You'll be surprised, ladies and gentlemen, on the hypnosis, how many of these alien abductions turned out to be some type of child abuse.
Exactly.
I
have a question for you, and I know it'd be speculation on your part because it's, how do you know if the number of people, let's say, that claim to be abducted by aliens or whatever, what percentage would you say are the credible ones? I mean, I know it's, you don't know what's in your mind.
I'll do something different for you. The researchers on the planet agree that it's 10 to 15% of the population so that it's experiencing this, whatever this is. It doesn't, case you ladies, you know, it doesn't matter what you think this is.
That sounds about
15%
right.
of our planet has experienced some kind of phenomena that nobody can explain. Now, they're saying it's alien abduction. That's what they're saying. And there's a lot of credible evidence, and there's a lot of circumstantial evidence. But when it comes right down to it, I don't have a gray in my possession that I can say 100% sure this is what's happening. This could be some kind of memory left from the past. Maybe we were a different kind of race. It could be a lot of things. Mass hypnosis is a little hard because it's on so many continents.
Exactly.
So that I got to rule that out. But to jump in and just automatically say, that's the whole thing that got me into this field 40 years ago.
Really?
To jump in and automatically and say, these are people are having alien abductions. At the time, I couldn't even fathom that aliens would even want to abduct anybody in this back ass rich planet. So, and then the problem I kept meeting is these brilliant people that are well-educated, well-mannered. You know, I was expecting to find some crazy hillbillies or something, and it wasn't. These were state-of-the-art people who had careers and families, and almost every credible one I met is somebody who's doing something. And what's weird about this is the ones that realize this is going on and deal with it, accept it, and go on with their life do really, really well for themselves. And another thing, the people in the field that marry each other stay married. They don't get divorced. The divorce rate amongst contactees that marry each other is like almost 0%. It's
really
a very strange thing.
You know,
but you know,
it's something that would to me would draw them together. Like anything, if you had or even a mystical experience, you know, Joe, and someone else had a similar one.
I agree.
You know, that's an interesting statistic. Oh, I have a question for you too. This, because I know we have other questions, but you know, this is an area of your specialty, and I know very little about it. But one, you know, I used to teach human gross anatomy using cadavers. That was one of the best dissectors. When they find these cattle mutilations and whatever, it seems like the instruments that they've used, and they don't have any blood, is beyond anything that I'm aware of our technology. What's your take on that?
I'll help you with this. So first off, it's not beyond our technology. We can suck the blood out of a cow, a whole cow, in under 2 minutes. Boom. All you got to do is hook up a vacuum pump to the main artery. He's drained in less than 2 minutes. You can do a human in less than 35 seconds with a vacuum pump, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
This is technology we've had since the turn of the last, or century before last. I'm sorry, I forgot we just turned a century. Well, anyway, 2 centuries back, but we've been having this since the 1900s.
I thought the cattle mutilation ones, the blood is like not even like a droplet of blood. And I don't know.
You would suck it out. A vacuum pump would pretty much suck it dry. And now on top of that, we've had field lasers since 69, I believe. 69 or 70, somewhere around there. Now, don't get me wrong. When I say a field laser, this thing was like the size of a minivan. Okay, it wasn't some little handheld laser today. Today, they actually got handheld lasers. But I'm going to give y'all something that no one ever thought about, including Linda Melody Howe, except for me. So I decided to ask the rancher something. First off, did y'all know there's rarely ever a cattle mutilation east of the Mississippi River? Did you know that?
What's that?
That said there's no cattle mutilations east of the Mississippi River. They're all out west almost. Almost all out west.
Yeah. Really?
Yeah, so well, there's just none. It's better than that. So I started calling these ranchers and asking them, are your cows insured? And guess what? They were. So now you've got cows being taken that now the only way the rancher can get his money is if they have the carcass. So the carcass is left behind. But all the parts removed from the cow, with lasers, by the way, are parts where radiation would show up first. All the states where the mass cattle mutilations are being done are all states where there was nuclear testing in the 50s.
Fascinating.
So here you've got an area that you know was being nuclear tested. Now you're taking the animals and you're taking the parts out where radiation would show up first, in the lymph nodes and glands and certain organs where it would concentrate. This was a way of testing the animals because mutilations have almost stopped now. This was a way of just testing to make sure that there was nothing getting into the food supply without causing a national incident and causing a bunch of lawsuits because they were testing for radiation. But that's what they are, because there's really no cattle mutilations in Europe. And the ones in South America turned out to be fake. There was some general.
I was just going to ask you about that, if there are any in Europe or Africa, South America. Yeah.
No, really, it's really a West Coast, Western American thing. There was some in Brazil, but they found out some general down there was stuffing them into water towers so he could collect the insurance money on them.
That I never heard. That is fascinating. Yeah. Yeah. You would think, though, the insurance people would be on it, though, and now that you know, you're mentioning it, that they would maybe. Did they question the claims?
Yeah, they did. They still had to pay the claim because the animal was dead and they had the carcass. But even they questioned what was being removed.
Interesting.
And a lot of times there were skid marks found near the locations, suggesting there was some type of helicopter or something coming in. Something, because there was no saucer circles found or anything like that. And it was rare that there was even a UFO sighted when there was a mutilation going on. I know Linda Mullen Howe tried to plane it another way, but when I checked her facts, that wasn't a fact. The fact was it was very rare. And even the police, when I talked to several of the police in Arizona and New Mexico, and even the ones in Colorado, said they thought it was something else, because they thought it was suspicious too that none of the non-insured cows were being taken, because there are farmers out there that didn't have insurance. But we could not find one cattle rancher or anybody who had cows that did not have insurance on their cows. And so I got really suspicious. At first, I was like, maybe it's a scam. But then I realized there was something else going on. So I talked to a doctor friend of mine who's still a good friend of mine today. And I talked to her about it. I said, tell me about these parts. So we got a list of the parts being taken. And she said, oh, Joe, there is some common with that. I'm like, what? She said, that's where radiation would accumulate first. So I went and looked it up online, and sure enough, even though I trust, I still wanted to, you know, verify it. And sure enough, it's where it was. The only thing Linda Howe ever said that she tried to get credibility was she said the heart was moving while it was still inside the sack, and it was removed from outside the sack without damaging it. But I couldn't find any actual reports of that. I have to take her at her word. Every report I found said the heart was just cut out with a laser or some type of laser-type instrument. So these were just areas. I mean, they didn't take it. They didn't mess with any of the beef or anything. They were just glands and certain organs where radiation would accumulate first. And it could have been E.T. was checking it, but why wouldn't E.T. just zap the whole damn cow or just scan the cow? You know, it just didn't make any sense.
Take a sample and, you know, I mean.
And drop the cow in a wood somewhere, you know, I mean, I just. None of it made any sense that it was done there at the spot where the cow was killed.
No, they take the cow and bring it over to Uncle Guido in Brooklyn.
That works, you know. Go drop it off at one of the orphanages or something. But
to this day
in the South, people donate deer all the time that they hit with the cars and stuff to the orphanages.
I'm in Minnesota, and I know, boy, you see them a lot of times crossing the street. Thank God I haven't hit one yet. I remember when I used to listen to Art Bell years ago before I was even into this research. I remember listening to Linda Moulton Howe talk about it. And again, I didn't know anything about it. She knows about this stuff, right? That you just talked about. Does that?
No, she does. No, her and I forgot where we were, some conference somewhere, and I was giving a lecture. Mm. And the whole time I was giving a lecture, she was sitting in the audience shaking her head like that, and somebody started laughing. Somebody started laughing at her, and she said something to the guy. Guy said, turned around, looked at me, he said, "Joe just disproved everything you've ever said. You should just be pissed." And she said, I told him, he said, "And I got to tell you, I believe him more than I believe you now." He said, his explanation is much more plausible than yours, because mine didn't have extraterrestrials involved in it. You know, there was no need for E.T. I just couldn't find a reason why E.T. would be interested. Yeah, they don't mutilate humans like that. So why the hell are they mutilating cows like that?
Again, Occam's razor. You explained it the most simplest logical way, and that's the most reasonable way it occurred. That's funny. Yeah,
that's what made me so unpopular in ufology, because I rewrote the Betty and Barney Hill case. I rewrote the Roswell case. Because, you know, I found out in Roswell that there were two crash sites. So I was like, well, wait a minute. What the hell? And that's something Dennis Belfase and I talked about on many occasions, that there was the Corona crash and the other one.
And Stanton, I remember, wrote a book on that, you know. And, oh, the other thing about Stanton, when I first met him, he sent me every one of his books signed for free. Can you believe that guy?
He was a good guy, man. He'd always send me a new book.
For me, it was Stan, because he spent a lot of time with me, and I love Stan. And Dennis, too, of course.
Well, I like Stan. I like Dennis. I like Lloyd Pye. Lloyd Pye was a lot of fun to talk to.
He's another
one that had a degree, but then he took his degree and decided to be a cryptozoologist. He still, until the day he died, maintained that Bigfoot was Neanderthal, the natural progression of Neanderthal.
Well, that's interesting.
So, you know, and yeah, he said he had evidence for it. He had a good argument for whether he could prove it. I don't think so, but he had a good argument for it. I'll give him that. And about him and I talked about a lot of other stuff, because he had the Star Child skull and he had brought it to dinner, and we got to examine it up close and personal, which was really nice of him, because the very first time I met him, he let me see the artificial one, the replica. And the second time we met at dinner, he brought the real one. And that skull, John, it was so light. It almost felt like styrofoam. It was so light. Because the skull was big, and it was bigger than mine, and it was light. I mean, it was so weird. You could tell there must have been like, the cavity must have had like been like honeycombed or something. It couldn't have been solid all the way through. Definitely the front side was much bigger than a normal human. Doesn't, by the way, ladies and gentlemen, none of that means it was alien. It could have been some kind of throwback or some kind of new genome coming
variation,
out.
Or
something that went extinct, or something that was going to maybe take us past us and got killed. There's just no real way of knowing. All they know for sure is one part of the DNA is not coming up right. It doesn't mean it's alien. It could be, but it doesn't mean that's what it is. It just means that we know the mother was human for sure. The father, for some reason, isn't testing the way it should be. And it needs more testing. But, you know, those kind of tests are expensive, $40,000, $50,000. So unless somebody's going to put up the money to have it tested a few more times, I don't think we'll ever know the truth about it. And it's a fascinating conversation piece. It could be alien. It could be some kind of weird throwback. It could be some kind of mutation. It could be anything. We mutate a lot. Things on our planet mutate a lot. So it could easily be a mutation. But
yeah,
whatever it is, it's fascinating.
I would love that. I mean, I'm not a geneticist.
I probably didn't want to show it. They'd probably enjoy coming off this.
But, you know, I had a lot of classes in genetics. I actually did some research at the human genetics lab at Johns Hopkins. But I'm not a geneticist. But this kind of stuff really fascinates me, because it really throws a light on a lot of the maybe legends, like vampires. Were vampires genetic aberrations, and or these whatever different, you know, whatever. What am I thinking of? You know, werewolves and things like that.
Oh yeah, it's all cryptid stuff there.
Yeah, it's a fact. I mean, I know nothing about it. I can't make.
You know, matter of fact, I heard Nick Redfern on the Outer Realm.
Oh, I love Nick. I was with him.
He was talking about cryptids, but they were doing underwater cryptids last night, is what they were doing.
Oh my God. Nick is great.
It was pretty good. Yeah, it was a pretty good show.
Can we get him on our show? I haven't seen him in like...
Yeah, we'll give him a call in. You know, I'll get his number from the girls and we'll get him a call.
I got to tell you this funny story where Nick was... I love digressing. Look, I'm a professor. Somebody said to me, you always digress. I said, listen, that's an occupational hazard of being a professor. But I was at a expo where I was a speaker and Nick was there and Giorgio and Von Donegan, right? You know, and so I'm having lunch with them and with Von Donegan, and we're talking about because you know I'm director of the Great Pyramid of Giza Research Association. He discovered some symbols, and we were talking about doing some work. So I mentioned that I wrote a book called Decoding the Pyramids, which Barnes and Noble's published, and it was like their Father's Day gift, and it's out of print, so I'm not trying to sell my books. And a Dead Sea Scroll book that I wrote for Barnes and Noble's, which was used at the Dead Sea Scroll exhibit. So Eric says, do you have copies of those? And I said, well, they're out of print. I may have some in my car. So I asked my son to go through my car, and he comes back with two copies of it. And I give them to Eric, and he goes, I'll read these on the way back to Switzerland. And then he says, will you sign them for me? I said, sure. And my wife was alive at that time. She took a picture of me with Eric signing. And I'm Joe, the feeling I got, I read his book, Chariot of the Gods, right, when it came out back in the 70s. Yeah. He was like, look, there's a lot of controversy, but I love the guy. Here I am sitting at lunch signing my books for Eric Von Doniggen. I can't tell you, that was one of the highlights of my life. It was like, yeah. Thank God my wife took that picture.
And he, you know, he enjoyed that. His English wasn't real great, but I interviewed him one time, and it was a really hard interview because his English was kind of hard sometimes. But him and what was the other guy's English was bad too. Billy Myers. Billy Myers' English was another one that.
Oh, really?
Most of his books are written in whatever his native language is. That's what made it so hard about him, is everything had to be translated. If you wanted to know anything about it, and people don't realize, because you know everybody always gives him shit about faking and hoax, and then I'm sure some of the stuff he did was a hoax, because it looks like some of it was, but that had to be the early stuff, because you know, he lost his arm. And he used to ride on his little moped thing and go out there to take pitches, you know, and carry everything on one arm. So he's kind of, hard for him to hoax some of this stuff. But some of it is definitely a hoax. You can tell by the lighting and the tree and the UFO, but some of it's not. And I think what happens to all of these people eventually is they get used to the little bit of fame you get with it when you come out, and they start missing it. And if the UFO don't come back or something don't come back, then you try to figure out a way to make it. And if it still don't, then a lot of them try to hoax it. And some of them pretty good at it. Some of them not as good at it. So it happens a lot. It happens with stories too. When people sometimes, you can tell when you do a regression, you're going to get the original story. You're going to get most of the story. But when, you know, a year down, 5 years down, all of a sudden it starts taking this weird turn. That's one of the reasons me and Betty's niece used to get into it, because she tried to change everything that Betty Hill said.
She just contacted me a couple of weeks ago. I asked her about coming on, and she's going on a trip. So she said she'd come on as a guest.
We've had many, her and I've had some heated conversations, because I rewrote the Betty and Barney Hill, the entire case. I was like, you know, after getting hold to Simon's regression tapes and listening to those interviews in 68, 69, and 70, I realized that, no, they weren't abducted by aliens in the United States. They were mill-labbed. There was no doubt that they were mill-labbed. Everything they said suggests they were mill-labbed. From the fact that whatever it was so the case is, the thing came down on the side of the road, and a set of stairs came down. And these four people came walking out of it and walked over to the car, because the car had stopped. And this is both their cases say this. Four men dressed in black shoes, black pants, black shirts, and black duckbill caps looped their arms around them and gently walked them across the street and through the dirt and up to the craft. And then they walked up a set of steel stairs into the craft, where they proceeded to walk through some swinging metal doors. And all my time of listening to alien contact, that hasn't happened to anybody but them. And worse than that, most of the stuff she describes is stuff that the CDC would do for someone who may have been contaminated, from different fluid samples to scrapings with razors, things taken with needles. Yeah, that's the original account. Now, Betty, her niece tried to change that. Betty talked about pull down maps. Okay. And her niece said, oh, it was digital televisions. That's not, you know, Betty wouldn't even know what a digital television was, because they didn't exist back then. So she was just trying to ad lib in places she shouldn't have. And she should have known someone like me were going to correct her when she tried to say, oh, the dress was analyzed. Yeah. 50 years after the fact, that means diddly squat. I don't care what you found. 50 years after the fact, that could have came from anywhere. God knows what that dress had been around. So, you know, that was the thing. And then they tried to say they had the car analyzed like 40 years later. I said, none of that matters. it's too long. You've let it go too long to try to use that. And then what's her name said she found the star map. But the problem with the star map is she couldn't have found the star map. She didn't have a point of reference from where they came from. All she knew is she was on Earth. So she was looking at a set of stars from a picture of Earth when the set of stars she was looking at was taken from their home world. So there's no way you could have identified that. You can arrange stars in the sky however you want. You and I both know that. You can take nine stars and go out and find them in the sky somewhere. Let's just be
honest.
Of course. Don't do stuff like that, because for the hardcore researcher, that turns us off. That just looks like you're trying to sell a book is what that looks like. It doesn't look like that you're doing real hardcore research. It just looks like you're trying to get a book out there and get it sold. I got to be honest, I always thought just Barney was the contactee. I never thought Betty was the contactee. Barney had issues. See, this is what got George Norton. Barney had issues when he was a kid. He was seeing psychiatrists at a very young age. Not uncommon for a contactee at a young age having experience. He also knew full bird colonels from the Air Force for a man who didn't serve or didn't serve in that way. So he had a colonel that lived with him. He was friends with a colonel. And then he was a biracial couple postman that got invited to meet the president at the White House in 1969. Wow. And you don't think there was something funny going on there. So, you know, all of this stuff adds up to something was going on. And they knew. See, the Air Force knew he'd been being taken since he was a young man. That's why those people befriended him. That's why an Air Force guy was living in his house so he would know. What happened was, by their own account, they went to Canada, right? So they stayed at a hotel. They spent the night. They left the hotel. They went and had breakfast. So they couldn't tell you the name of the hotel they stayed at. Neither one could tell you. And they couldn't tell you the name of the restaurant that was across the street from the hotel where they had breakfast that morning. They still couldn't tell you the name of the hotel, even though they were looking at it the whole time they were having breakfast. A little weird. Later in the day, they were asking for directions to get home. Barney describes him as a black police officer. Betty described him as a white Irishman.
Oh, wow. What a difference.
Yeah, what a difference. So that's typical alien abduction 101 is what that is. So the Air Force knew they got zapped. They were probably monitoring them, figured out they got zapped. So when they came back in the United States, they mill-labbed them. And they brought the CDC in to do all those samples and check everything out to see what they could learn from it. But instead of Kathleen actually going for the truth, she was already written her book, and she just needed to try to sell that book, which just doesn't paint as a true case. And like I told her, I said, I've got way more experience in investigating this than you do. And I said, I do have the original tapes. I said, and you can clearly hear in Barney's thing, there is fear and horror in Barney. That's not in Betty. I mean, you can hear it in Barney. And there's three sets of memories. So, which suggests that what you've got is the original abduction, the military abduction, and the cover-up. So you got three sets of memories.
Fascinating.
Yeah. So, and that's what happens with these contactees. That's one of the weird things that lets you know that there's some truth to what's going on. When you get in somebody's head and you find sets of memories, you know somebody's screwing around with something, because you're not doing it to yourself. So you know something's going on. But it still doesn't prove aliens, people.
No, I that's interesting. I didn't know a lot about that. I want to just offer to be fair to people that we talked about that, you know, they're welcome to come on our show if they want and tell their side. We're not at least me, I'm not making any judgments. We're just kind of reporting what our opinions are, what we've heard. But like Bob Lazar, I'd love to have him come on.
I won't let John pick on y'all, I promise.
Okay, and then I really would. I mean, when I watched him, I was very impressed with him, and I would love to talk to him. And I mean, in a not challenging way, let him tell his story. Linda Moulton Howe, I would love to let her. And Kathleen said she would come on when she got back. So
yeah, let her come on and tell her story.
Yeah,
let the audience deal with them.
Yeah, you and I, we're very open. You know, the thing about us too, we know. We don't have all the answers. A lot of it is speculation. We try to work with the facts we have. And look, people like to see both sides of the story. Did we mention anybody else that we want to give an open invitation to?
There's a couple of scientists I want to bring on. And I really want to bring back on Keiku, because I really want to get back into the stepping stone thing. I want people to understand how easy it is for aliens to visit our planet. Everybody always tells me, oh, it's physically, blah, blah, blah. Well, you know what? I did a show with Michio Keiko, and we got into this in depth. Now he's a he's a theoretical physicist and knows more about this than I do by far, as far as that end of it goes. Now don't get me wrong, I know a lot of my science really good because it's but anyway. But
who, Joe? I miss his name. Who are you mentioning?
Mr. Yokeka.
Oh, he's a friend of mine. We used to exchange because my specialty was string theory. We used to exchange emails. He even sent my son some papers. So he is a wonderful.
He's a great.
He's at CCNY and.
And I was really surprised when he came on UFO on the cover. I mean, when he had his books and all that, he came on. But the conversation was, guys and girls. So I got him on, and we just started discussing extraterrestrials. And I was asking why he didn't think they were here today. And so I said, well, can I talk to you about something? You can tell me what you think. I said, so let's do this, Michio. I said, so we put a mini base on the moon so we can mine helium-3. We set a launching platform in zone L11, which is a zone between the moon and Mars. It's a straight out shot out of the solar system. It's like taking a shortcut. It allows us to slingshot around a couple of planets and really pick up some serious speed. So we build a platform for there to zing out. Meanwhile, we're already going to be colonizing Mars and probably building stuff in the asteroid field. That's where we're headed right now. So once we get there, we got stepping stones. So then the next place is you're going to put a base on Titan or Io or somewhere out there. You're going to put another one probably out by Pluto. You're going to put another one out on the dark side of the Oort cloud. But once you get to the other side of the Oort cloud, ladies and gentlemen, we're 2 light years out. Now we're only 1.8 light years from Vega. So you can go halfway to Vega, which is 1 light year out, and put a station. And now you're only 8.8 light years from Vega. The reason I bring this up, because even at half a light speed, you can be to Vega in less than 8 years. Now, yeah, it sounds like a long time, but when you're talking about galactic travel, it's a drop in the bucket. So it shows us that we can be to Vega, and we're talking with current technologies. We're not even talking with anything better, like with some of the stuff they're working on right now that actually is going to move a lot faster. We're talking 50% light speed. Right now, we're looking at engines being developed that should push us 70, 75, 77, 80%. And then I guess we'll find out how Einstein's theories really work the closer we get to light speed. But anyway, I mean, I don't know if we'll ever get there or not, but we can get up there. We don't want to get too far up anyway, because then when you get time coalition and other problems, but, depending on it now, and that all depends on if you can come up with inertial dampness, which would cancel that out. There's a lot of stuff to think about there. But anyway, just basically just using wind sails or ion drives or things like that, we can achieve 60, 65% of light speed, which gets us all over the place. So look at it from our point of view as Earthlings. They have expanded the size of our galaxy from 100 light years to 160,000 light years across. So at half a light speed, you can explore the entire galaxy in 320,000 years. It's a long time, but we're a race that's supposed to live several billion years. So if it's true and we lived our planet's end, which is 4.5 billion years, then we could have explored our own galaxy more than 50 times. That means we would have colonies and we would have outposts and bases. I'm not saying you're leaving for Earth and going to way out on the other side, but you will already have people there, and you'll always be moving around. So there'll always be people leaving, stepping, going, stepping, people being born, stepping, and you will just steadily be moving out and expanding each time. And you don't have to have faster than light travel to explore the galaxy. And Michio was like, he really liked it. We got into really in-depth conversation about how it could be done, what we should be looking at, because, you know, you don't want to have people cooped up in a spaceship like Proxima. At half light speed, a straight run is 8 years. You don't want to have people cooped up in a spaceship for 8 years. Make it 10 or 12 years and let them stay off at this base and rest for a little while and eat and gather strength and get resources. You know, you'll have different bases that'll be doing different things. Some will be making fuel. Some will be growing food. Some will be producing water. Just depends where they are. But that allows you to move through our solar system and out of it fairly quickly. And then it allows you to get into other ones. And it's all technology that we have today. So in 100 years or 500 years, the technology will be much better and much faster and much cleaner. So it's just a matter of getting there. In private way is the way to go. That's the reason I told everybody this 20, 30 years ago, actually, when I started doing radio.
Oh, I was going to say that sound was not people shooting at me. I know with my Mafia show, I'm opening my show. That was the lightning and thunder, which I was warning Joe. I was saying, I hope I don't get disconnected. You know, I'd love to get on. I don't know him, but, you know, Neil deGrasse Tyson, because
he's fun to talk to.
I want to argue with him about Pluto. I believe Pluto's still a planet, and it was just done for politics.
You know what's funny about that, John? Now, I'll tell y'all a little secret about Pluto, because, you know, Pluto, they think they have liquid water on Pluto now. So what's going to happen with Pluto, Pluto is going to become a stepping stone. It's going to be where we put a base or so when we do that, it will become a planet again, because it's got its own moon. It's got Charon as a moon. So so it'll become a planet again. It'll be a little tiny planet, mind you, but it'll still be a planet. Yeah, Pluto has turned out to be a lot. Remember, we were all taught in school it's a big frozen ball of rock. Come to find out, that bitch is active all over the place. It's geologically active. It has liquid water. It has liquid hydrogen. There's all kind of wild stuff going on. And nobody knows how it's staying warm enough to do it. Scientists are perplexed. They're thinking maybe Charon's producing enough stress to make the core hot enough to do something. And that may be it. But it proves that you don't necessarily have to have sunlight to have an active planet.
Isn't that interesting?
That was very interesting.
That was one of the most interesting, you know, conclusions from our observations. But
yes, I know sci-fi figured that out decades ago, but real science has figured it out now, so it makes it better.
I really wanted to be an astronomer as a kid. I wanted to be everything.
I've been an amateur astronomer.
I've read the Universe and Dr. Einstein in junior high, and that I decided at that point I definitely want to be a theoretical physicist or whatever, and I don't know if I'd made the right decision, but I like physics. I'm really a biophysicist. My undergraduate degrees in physics, and my graduate degrees are in biophysics, and I'm interested in the paranormal, crystal skulls, and magic. People would say, "How the hell did you get from physics to crystal skulls?"
Yeah, it ain't that big of a leap. I'll tell you, I know quite a few people in physics
People like me, and I really consider myself a true scientist, because actually I try to live my life by the scientific method. A true scientist is interested in everything. He looks at the universe with awe and wonder. And just for young people out there listening, follow your dreams. Pick a subject, a topic, a major that you really are interested in, and also make sure you're good at it. Because if you're not good at math, don't go into physics. But I always say, if you want to be successful, it's got to be something you like, something you're good at, and hopefully, right, Joe, you can get a job doing it.
Yeah, I hope you get a job doing it. Well, no, to answer a question, somebody asked me earlier, why did I get a bachelor's and get into a different career? Well, to be honest, it's not exactly how it happened. How it happened was I went in the Navy and got advanced degrees in avionics and electronics, seriously advanced degrees in avionics and electronics. And then when I got out of the Navy, I was about 10 years, a friend of mine said, "I don't know why you don't go get your bachelor's. You know, you got your education for it." So I called, that was Delta College. And I called him up and said, "How can I go about going ahead and get my bachelor's?" He said, "Well, you know, you have to go back to school for about two and a half years since you've already been in the Navy. And then you can go ahead and get it." And what really happened was they sent me an online test to take to qualify to see where I needed to start. I aced the test. So he calls me and he said, "Why are you going to school?" He says, "There's nothing else we can teach you." He said, "You probably know more than our teachers do." And I was like, "Well," I said, "I did it in active duty." And he's like, "Well," he said, "I'm just telling you, you're wasting your time." I said, "Yeah, if I don't go, I'm not going to get it." So in the end, what they did was they gave me a secondary test, and then they let me pay for the course, and they gave me my bachelor's, because they told me there's no reason, there's nothing else that can teach me. And even to make sure he didn't get in trouble, they got with the board, and then they got with two of the professors gave me a call, and they're like, "No, he knows more about this than we do," which I should, because I was in the field and they're just teaching. It's a difference. Teachers teach, and then people in the field learn what the teachers learn, plus they learn the shortcuts and other things that go on in the field. It's like any job. Hands-on training is a great training, but you still, in real life, you need the learning, you need the book education, and then you need the hands-on to really understand what it is. If you get both, you're going to do great.
What would you go into? Let's say you were young again. I wish I was young again. I won't say how old I am. And you were going to go to graduate school and get a graduate degree.
I thought about that a couple of times. I actually thought about maybe psychology at first.
Really?
Then I said, "No, I don't want to be psychoanalyzing people. They might start psychoanalyzing me."
How about medical school? Did you ever think of medical school?
I never did. For something about, I guess because I used to hunt when I was young, there was something about just cutting things up that didn't appeal to me. And it was kind of weird, but... you know, once you cut up a big animal like a cow or a deer, it gives you a different view on things. But there was a couple of things I thought about. And then I thought about getting into like aircraft design, or maybe I even thought about going to engineering school for a while. But, you know, engineers are at least respected scientists. People just shit on engineers. Engineers are brilliant. it's probably as smart as anybody with a PhD, but the problem is they're an engineer that don't have a PhD, so they just get shit all the time for it. I got a lot of friends of mine as engineers.
You know, it's funny you said that, because I went to an engineering school and I planned on becoming an engineer, and then I realized I just don't have the talent for it. You know, I mean,
yeah, it's different for different people. Yeah, I couldn't.
And math and physics was a natural for me. But I tell you, Joe, that was, one of the big mistakes I made. Because if I would have majored, let's say, even in chem eng or something like that, I would have been able to get a job right out of my, undergraduate. I wouldn't have to have, because if you want a PhD, if you major in science, you got to have a PhD in those days anyway.
Yeah,
but I could have, I think I could have had more doors open to me as an engineer than as a scientist.
Well, yeah, you probably would have, because engineers are so hard to seek after. But I thought about going to engineer. I actually thought about architect design and doing engineering through that.
Oh, that would be great. My daughter's a biomedical engineer, and she actually works for one of the big drug companies working on the vaccination. She actually volunteered to be in the trial, but they didn't let her. And I'm the one who told her she was going to go to college. She said, "I'm not sure I want to major in what to major in." I said, "Well, are you good in biology? Do you like that?" She said, "Yeah." "Are you good at math?" She said, "Yeah." I said, "Become a biomedical engineer. That's the top."
And they're needed. That's a field that needs people. I mean, that's a serious field that needs serious talent.
Here's the funny thing: both my wife and I graduated from Johns Hopkins. You know, me with a graduate degree, my wife undergraduate. We both alumnus. They had the number one biomedical engineering department in the country, and my daughter was A+ and everything. Couldn't get in. It was that competitive. And I guess we didn't donate enough money. I don't think we donated any money. Maybe that would have made a difference. Huh,
yeah, yeah, you know, you're giving that money. What do you mean, Kim? I didn't teach. Teach what? Oh, no, I'm not a good teacher. You can ask my son and my partners and stuff. No, I don't have the patience for teaching. Even when we're teaching other stuff, I usually let somebody else do it. I mean, I'll tell them how I want it done, but I'm just not that patient. It's I thought about it. A couple of friends, the Navy asked me to re-sign up and teach a course. And because I was so good at it, I was just a natural. I was a natural leader, but I was natural in electronics and avionics. And I just took to it. Well, you got to be good at math, and I was weird. I was good at some math and not other math. So you figure that one out. Yeah, the first time I had to do algebra, I was like, "What pi? What the pi? What are we eating pi? What are you talking about pi? Get off the pi thing, man!" And then one day I'm sitting there looking at it, and go, "Oh shit, that's what pi is." This is what I think. But advanced trigonometry I picked up like it was nothing. Don't ask me, people. It's just one of them weird things with my head how it works. But I enjoyed math. I always enjoyed science. At a very young age, I was into science. I used to get them Heath kits and build radios and CBs and police busters and all sorts of shit and radar snoopers. I had a lot of fun doing it. And I remember the first time I built a crystal set radio. I was like, "Wow, this actually works! Check it out!" I didn't think I could do it. You start off with something small and get into something bigger. And I had to learn a lot about frequencies in the Navy. That's what John and I were talking about earlier in the show. As we go more advanced science over the next decades, you're going to see a movement away from things like flare or cold or infrared or any of the different types of cameras like that. We're going to be going to a straight sensor society is what we're going to. We found that certain types of wavelengths can give us much more definition of something than we realize. I mean, you can use some that could just paint me completely. At 10 miles, it could hit me and just give you, it could even give you the hair on my face. That's how advance it. So that's the stuff we're going to be moving into. It's going to give us a big head on everybody else. It's not that the stuff we don't use now is great. I mean, I'm telling you, some of that stuff that the service used, how can I say this or not? Anyway, there's a system we use that you can uplink to. And I could tell you what color hair the pilot in front of me had. And it's not coming from the jet, by the way, that they're flying. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't need to get into no more of that. But I can only imagine today. That was 30 years ago. So I can only tell you what they got today. I got ideas because I talk to people about it all the time. But the technologies we use today, really, they've got satellites in space that can see the hair in the pimple on your ass from orbit. I'm not kidding y'all, people. They got some serious cameras out there. Even Google stuff. Matter of fact, in case y'all didn't see today, just some random satellite, some company that's got a satellite there, caught a Chinese sub going into an underground pen. got it on camera. And really? You, wow. Yeah, and it's clear. It's clear. It's not even zoomed in all the way. It's just zoomed in a little bit so you can tell what it is. But you could tell it could zoom all the way down to the craft. So it's better than remote viewing now, people. I'm just telling y'all, it's better than remote viewing now. We got serious technology these days, and it's fun to know and understand it and learn it. What do you got for us, Cal? We got to go in a minute. What you got? No, we were talking about the cameras earlier. And said, no, John and I just like to argue. Yeah, that's all it is.
Well, everybody seems to tune in when we argue. I mean, it's like.
I tell you what. What's up? First hours, we were booming. No.
Okay. Yeah, Joe, you know what I think
listen,
it is?
Hold on a second. Sure. Listen, guys. Go listen to the argument. What we were discussing was a thing. John was giving you the side from what he was talking about, Flair, and I was giving you that. I said, no, we just like to holler. He says, because it's more fun for us. But pay attention to what we're saying. Don't just listen to the argument. Listen to the content of the argument, because you're going to be missing out if you don't. Yeah, we like to insult and pick on each other, but there's actually serious stuff being said in that argument.
Yes, exactly.
So you know, go listen to that part of it. Go ahead,
John. Wanted to say, I think why it's so fascinating to people is how could two best friends go at each other like that, have fun, and not take it personally or emotional? And people have lost that today. Like people, if they find out you're voting for the person they don't like, they unfriend you or they don't talk to you.
Yeah, they do too. That's some whiny ass shit. You know, John's right, too, because most of my really good friends are close people I know. I can argue with them all day long. We'd be cussing each other, saying F you and a whole nine yards, and then go out and have dinner and talk about it just like John is talking right now. That's the difference between being real friends and fake friends, because fake friends would get their feelings hurt and wouldn't talk anymore.
Exactly.
And that's what it is. But see, we know we have a friendship, so we can talk about this, and he can insult me, and I can insult him, and then we can go on and have, like you just seen, an hour and a half of real conversation after we argued about the flare camera. So, yeah, see, that's how it is.
And that's the way a Sicilian family is, too, by the way, which is very
interesting. It is. A real family, that's how it is.
Yeah. When people used to visit us, like, you know, families would argue and they'd think, oh, these people are going to take out knives, and then they're all hugging and kissing.
I'd be like, go home, you biatch.
I kind of grew up with that. And it's kind of just fun. You know, but like I said, that it's maybe like today we don't see that. You just say you sneeze the wrong way and somebody gets insulted.
Oh, yeah, that's the thing. And that really is a thing, John. I mean, you know, you say something wrong now, people get all upset and get all offended. I remember I was talking to a guest about a year ago, and I said, do you really believe that? I thought they were going to start crying on me. I was like, you got to be shitting me. I said, well, it was nice having you on my radio show. I hope you enjoyed the hour. And I just dropped them and went on. And because I couldn't. Wow. If you're that weak, emotionally weak people, you shouldn't even be on the air with somebody like John or I. Even when we're playing, we're going to probably upset you. You know, because both of us have a particular style. You don't take my word for it. Go listen to John on Saturday. Oh, no, they were tearing up all kind of shit last Saturday. It's part of doing radio.
Hey, did somebody pick us up on the news? Joe, did somebody pick us up on the news or something? They heard
us. Yeah. We got what is her name? What the hell is her name? Anyway, we got an honorable mention on one of Fox's TV shows just recently. Plus, just the other day, I got on WWL a couple of times and talking about this particular show. And last I heard, Brunetti from Sean Hannity caught us and gave us an honorable mention too. So, this is the lady on Fox's afternoon show. This is what she said. Actually, this is what her co-host said. He said that he was telling her about us, and I didn't know this because somebody sent me the link. So he's saying, I was listening to these two guys. Man, he's going at this. He said, then I started listening. He said, man, they were making some serious points. And he said, man, and then you could hear it. Both of them were researched and based and stuff. And I was like, wow, who am I going to believe here? What's going on? And then we shifted mode on him, I guess, about halfway through the conversation like we did tonight. And he's like, all of a sudden, these guys are best friends and they're talking about all this information. And he said, I'm getting information overload. I don't know what's going on. I'm thrilled. I'm having fun. I'm learning. So he goes, now I've listened to all the shows. I guess he went and caught up on our shows. So he's telling his co-host about it. So she goes and listens to all the shows. When he comes back, he said, Jesus Christ, we need to bring these people on our show.
Oh, and, that's great.
And he's like, they are just so fun to listen to. And they both agreed they were getting an education and having fun at the same time. And you could hear them. And I knew they listened because certain words they said, I need either you or I said. You know, I could tell by the comment what they said. Because there's one time she was saying about, yeah, the one guy, John, was saying this. And I was just laughing. The guy, Joe, was like, what the ever, dude? It's like, he's like, these two are just insane. And then he said, then all of a sudden, he said, that's what's so weird. They'll be arguing, and boom, all of a sudden they're agreeing on something. And then they're going off talking about something else. He's like, man, don't let them agree. It's like, what the hell, man? But it was a lot of fun hearing that. And I know honorable mentions. And I've mentioned that show on Chris Como's show a couple times when I've got on or called in. So,
Hey, maybe we'll have our own History Channel series, huh?
Yeah, I know. I mean, but it was a lot. It was a lot of fun, people. We really enjoyed it. And it's just, you know, it's what we're here for. You can tell that John and I are having fun when we're doing these shows.
You really do.
It's good stress. Like the first half hour, John and I probably got a whole week's worth of stress out right there.
Well, you know, Joe, you said something really important to me when I started doing radio. You said you should only do radio if you enjoy it and it releases stress. Remember you told me that?
Yeah.
I never forgot that. And that's so true. And I think that's why our show is so
successful. I told him he's never going to hurt my feelings, tearing me up on the air because we're friends. It's, you know, yeah, we can be rude. What do you mean? Oh, yeah, we can be rude. Don't we? Yeah, because we know each other. We can be rude. We know how to get on each other's nerves.
True friends do that. Exactly. Yeah.
No, don't forget Wise Guys Inc. tomorrow. It's Nick, John, and Bill, right? Nick, John, and Bill.
Yeah, Nick, John, and Bill. Thank you.
Well, no, John. You mean John? Yeah, he's gonna stop by every once. Well, John's a busy guy, y'all. I mean, He's got the Fear City on Netflix. He's got other stuff going on. He's a busy guy. But yeah, I know he likes John.
No, John won't be on our show. He's gonna be like.
I know. That's what I'm saying. He'll just stop by and hang out with him and co-host with him or. Yeah. Guest out with him. No, he's a good guy. I liked him. Yeah, he's a great conversation with him.
Yeah, he's got a good show, the John and Gene show, and
he's got a good job listening to it.
And he appreciated, by the way, the plug you gave him last week. And but I want to, you know, before I guess we're running out, I want to make
sure talk about syndicating his other show. But I know we got to get out of here next week. Arthur and Margaret Speaks is going to come on. She's a PhD in a couple areas, and we're going to get on and talk to her. And I'll probably do some metaphysical stuff, maybe talk about some astro traveling, maybe we'll talk about some real science and other ways. John and I like to sneak in a little hardcore science in every show.
Exactly.
If y'all pay attention, you'll realize no matter what we're talking about, whether it's real science or something else, we're going to always sneak in a little science. Like the crowd of Shadow Touring. We argued the whole show, but there was a lot of science in that show.
And that's the beyond part, right, Joe?
I meant to tell you all about that shit. I know we got to go. So listen, a friend of mine listened to this show. Her son's a Catholic, not an archbishop. He's somewhere in between. Anyway, he's out of D.C. And then his bishop, they listened to Shroud of Turing show, by the way.
Oh, really? Fantastic.
And he said he really enjoyed it. He said the guest was great. He said the hosts were having a lot of fun. He said there was a lot of good conversation there. There was a lot of good points. We talked about a lot of stuff on that show. No, there wasn't much argument, if that's what you're asking. No, we didn't do much arguing in that show.
No, very little.
No, John and them were experts. I was there I was just kind of learning is what I was doing. I was just asking questions, and we argued a little bit about camera techniques, but nothing of any consequence. And for me, it was a learning experience. I'm not even going to lie. Shroud of Twins always been an interest to me, and it was a good show. It's a good, solid show. Y'all should go listen to it. John and what was his name? I forgot the name again.
Barry Schwartz. We were on. Yeah. I worked with him for over 30 years on the Shroud. He was fantastic.
Guest, and he was a great guest.
One of my best friends, too. Yep.
Really went through the shout proud pretty quick. What do you mean? Do we come to a conclusion if it was Christ or not? Is that what you're asking? Go listen to the show. How's that?
Good answer. Good, Joe. Love it.
Yes, but I'm just saying, that's what you want to know. Go listen to the show. You can write to John. You can catch John on Facebook. It's Dr. John DeSalvo. He's all over Facebook. Or you can catch him. He's going to give you the Wise Guy site in a few minutes when we get ready to roll out here in about a minute. Remember, ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to United Public Radio 107.7 out of New Orleans. This is Science and Beyond with Dr. John DeSalvo and Joe Montaldo. John, give him a kiss, and we're going to roll up on that.
Love you all. Thank you for listening. This website is wiseguysradio.com. wiseguysradio.com, and tomorrow's our second show, 4 to 5 p.m. Central, right here, same place. So thank you, Joe. Wonderful show. I had a blast tonight, and thanks for everything, buddy.
In the year 1858, the German explorer Heinrich Barth traveled across the wide expanse of the Sahara Desert. He was determined to reach the city of Timbuktu that lay at its far edge. He spoke Arabic, along with several African languages, and made careful notes about the places he passed through. His journey all around West Africa would ultimately be a trip of nearly 20,000 kilometers. But Bart was always on the lookout for more sights to see, and on the arduous return leg of his journey, he heard rumors of something that only a handful of Europeans had ever seen before. His guides told him of the existence of an enormous ruined city lost in the African bush, a city that had once commanded the continent's greatest empire. His guides called this city Gao.
As soon as I had made out that Gao was the place which for several centuries had been the capital of a strong and mighty empire in this region, I felt a more ardent desire to visit it than I had to reach Timbuktu. Gao had been the centre of a great national movement from whence powerful and successful princes spread their conquests.
Bart gathered his things and set out, following the Niger River along with his guides, through the swampy lowlands and flat desert plains, swatting away mosquitoes and tsetse flies, until he reached the site of the former city. But what he saw disappointed him. He found only a small collection of huts, about 300 in total, with heaps of overgrown rubble where the ancient city had once stood.
This once busy locality, which, according to the unanimous statements of former writers, was the most splendid city of Africa, is now the desolate abode of a small and miserable population. Just opposite my tent lay the ruined massive tower, the last remains of the principal mosque of the capital. All around the wide open area in which we were encamped was woven a rich corona of vegetation, among which, in the clear light of the morning, I discovered date palms, tamarind trees, sycamores, and silk cottons.
Not to be deterred, Bart explored the ruins of the ancient city and took detailed notes about what he saw.
The town, in its most flourishing period, seems to have had a circumference of about 6 miles. The east quarter of the mosque is entirely girded with a thick grove of siwak bushes, which covers all the uninhabited part of the former city. The mosque consisted originally of a low building flanked on the east and west side by a large tower, the whole courtyard being surrounded by a wall about 8 feet in height. The eastern tower is in ruins, but the western one is still tolerably well preserved. It rises in 7 terraces, which gradually decrease in diameter. The inhabitants still offer their prayers in this sacred space where their great conqueror is interred, although they have not sufficient energy to repair the hole.
His guides told him that this had been the capital of an empire known as the Songhai. Bart soon left the ruins of Gao to the silk cottons and sycamore trees and continued on his journey home. But the sight of the ruined city seems to have stuck with him, and wherever he went, he would ask the same questions. How had the Empire of Songhai grown to such size in the harsh desert landscape of the Southern Sahara? How had its people held such a society together and built such grand constructions? And why, after rising to such great heights, had they left it all here to crumble into the dust and shifting dunes of the desert? My name's Paul Cooper, and you're listening to the Fall of Civilizations podcast. Every episode, I look at a civilization of the past that rose to glory and then collapsed into the ashes of history. I want to ask, what did they have in common? What led to their fall? And what did it feel like to be a person alive at the time, who witnessed the end of their world? In this episode, I want to look at a society that has been all but forgotten by popular narratives of history, the Songhai people of West Africa. I want to explore how this great civilization rose up among some of the harshest conditions our planet can throw at us, how they united two warring traditions, became a cosmopolitan and pluralistic society, as well as Africa's greatest empire. And I want to explain why, after barely more than a century of greatness, their whole society collapsed around them. This will be an episode about cycles. And our first cycle is that of the planet Earth itself. As the Earth spins through the dark void of space, it turns on its axis, giving us the cycle of night and day. But there's another planetary cycle that affects us all just as profoundly, although it is much, much slower. This is the wobble of the Earth, known more scientifically as its axial precession. This wobble is caused by the gentle gravitational tug of the other planets in our solar system, and it changes the angle of the planet's tilt by about 1 degree every 72 years, until it tilts a full 23 degrees each way. This cycle lasts for over 25,000 years, and this tilt can have some extreme effects on the climate on the planet's surface. Over the last 8,000 years or so, one of these effects has been to shift the pattern of monsoon rains on the African continent.